Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. Last November, a day after the nation elected Donald Trump president, California's top Democratic lawmakers, Kevin DeLeon and Anthony Rendon, issued a bold joint statement. In it, they vowed to lead the resistance to any effort that would shred our social fabric or our Constitution, and called California the keeper of the nation's future. In the year since the election, California and its cities and citizens have mounted a range of challenges to the administration's executive and agency actions. Governor Jerry Brown signed a bill extending the state's cap-and-trade system and a series of bills shielding undocumented immigrants from deportation. Attorney General Javier Becerra has sued to block numerous Trump directives, including the proposed construction of a border wall. At the local level, San Francisco and Oakland sued to force oil companies to pay for damages related to climate change. And citizens across the state have donated money and engaged in protests, demonstrations, and boycotts in the fight against Washington. This hour, we'll talk about how California has fared as the vanguard of the Trump resistance. In what areas has it influenced national law and policy? What are the limits of resistance? And when might it be in the state's interest to stand down? Joining me in the studio this evening to talk about these issues and more are Carla Marinucci, California Playbook reporter for Politico. Previously, she was senior political writer for the San Francisco Chronicle. Welcome, Carla.
Good to be with you.
And welcome back to Joe Eskenazi, editor-at-large at San Francisco Magazine. He's also a columnist with Mission Local. Welcome,
thanks.
Joe.
Thanks for having me.
And also we're joined by Jason McDaniel, associate professor of political science at San Francisco State University, where he specializes in urban politics and voting behavior. Welcome, Jason.
Glad to be here.
And we'll also invite you, our listeners, to join our conversation. There are lots of ways to reach us. Call us on our toll-free line. That's 866-798-TALK. Also 866-798-8255. You can email or text us now at cityvisions@kalw.org. Post a comment at the KALW website or on our Facebook page. And you can also tweet us at cityvisions@kalw. So, Carla Marinucci, I wanted to start with you. So, Anthony Rendon and Kevin DeLeon, they put it down. They laid it on the line last November. In a quick, brief overview, how did they and the rest of Sacramento do in the last year with being at the front of the resistance?
That's right. Well, I mean, I think California has defined itself as a state of resistance against Donald Trump. I mean, what a difference a year makes. A lot of people in California certainly remember the moment when they heard that Donald Trump was elected president, and I think haven't recovered since. And that attitude of resistance, as expressed by Kevin DeLeon, the state Senate leader, by Governor Jerry Brown, who's in Europe as we speak, pushing back on Donald Trump with regard to climate change. I mean, he's become the de facto U.S. ambassador on climate change. And has been very, very consistent in pushing back on Trump. And on so many different levels. You mentioned Javier Becerra, who again tomorrow is going to be talking about criminal justice issues and criminal reform and immigrants' rights. He hasn't stopped pushing back since he became the Attorney General of California. You can go to our senators. Both Dianne Feinstein and Kamala Harris have been very critical and on critical committees there in Washington. And I think, and you're seeing it at the state and local level too, from, as you mentioned, from issues from immigrant rights, which are so important to California, to technology, H-1B visas. You can go down the line, environmental issues, regulatory reform. A lot of Californians have watched this last year under the Trump administration just in pain, watching some of the impacts here in the state, even on issues like how much is it going to cost to drive into the national parks. Dianne Feinstein just protested that last week, a bump up to $71. The Republican tax plan, which is being introduced as we speak, a lot of folks in Washington and here both believe that California is going to get absolutely hammered in this tax plan, and homeowners are going to be hammered, and it's student loan holders up and down the line. So when you talk about the effects, it's kind of hard to calculate. There are many, many effects of the Trump administration in just 1 year.
And how effective has the rhetoric and the vocal protests of a lot of the politicians you've named. How effective has it been?
I think we're gonna find out in 2018, because you've got a number of GOP House seats here, 7 particularly, that are especially vulnerable in districts that were won by Hillary Clinton in 2016. And you need, more than a quarter of all the House seats needed to flip the House back to the Democrats are here in California. A lot of people feel that those may be the key. We're going to see how effective this California State of Resistance campaign has been in 2018. I think that's going to be the measure.
And we'll go through a little bit of the playbook, so to speak,
yeah.
The ways that they've put those words into action in just a moment. But I want to turn to Jason McDaniel next. Put California's stance in context with other parts of the country, other large metropolitan areas, and tie it together for us, or not. Perhaps there's different strategies across the country.
Well, I'm struck actually, hearing the rundown that Carla made by sort of the low-key, no-drama sort of leadership and focus on governance that we see here in California. So it's not just big issues and big press conferences and lawsuits, which are important and matter to people's lives, will matter to people's lives. But the way in which the sort of leaders of the state are keeping their head down, focusing on governance, and not being torn apart. Our state is not being, I think, torn apart by some of the racially divisive tactics that people like Steve Bannon and brought into the White House especially and that Trump seems so taken with, right? And so that's, looking back on this last year, I'm struck by those states, metropolitan areas, especially mayors, that are just focusing on doing their job and not getting distracted. And I'm thinking about, for instance, Eric Garcetti, getting the Olympics, another example of Californians, working together, bringing something like that to L.A., they made a plan for that, and working with Trump a little bit, or at least, they worked with Trump a little bit on that, right? So, again, I'm just struck by the differences in approach that we see in California and in places that are successful around the country in resisting that kind of lowering themselves, perhaps, to this kind of politics.
Hmm. And Joe Eskenazi, let's take it really local to the Bay Area and San Francisco. Lots of energy in the area right after the election. Demonstrations, in the early part of the Trump administration. Where has that energy gone? Is it still there? And what has it led to?
Well, if you're looking at government, I think. Among people in San Francisco government, at least that I talked to, they can boil it down to 3 things that our government has done. One of them is that we've sued where appropriate, and we've won those suits, and we've also joined in other suits. San Francisco was victorious, or at least victorious so far, both in the sanctuary cities suit and in the subsequent one about grants, which was less money. Would have been about $1.5 million for San Francisco and $28 million for the state. Second. We have backfilled where money has been jeopardized or taken away. The city has backfilled, and some of these have been contentious issues, and some of them have been very political, such as how much money and how many employees we should put towards immigrant legal resources. But money was provided, and we can argue about whether it was enough. But we have been backfilling. And the third is, and this is either the most important or the least important, depending upon your time frame, the city has actually been providing some leadership by example when it comes to how, for example, to write a non-discrimination laws. Some cities don't have those, and now the federal government has little interest in providing leadership on that. So it does matter that San Francisco, which has lawmakers who have written effective laws about those sorts of things, can help them not reinvent the wheel. So those are the 3 things government has done.
Hmm. How about people?
Well, people, first of all, California is everyone's ATM. Our money is going to lots of different places, and technologically proficient people are working very hard, hopefully for them to elect Democrats in places like Virginia. This is the second straight time I've mentioned a story by my former colleague Lauren Smiley, but in Wired there was a story about tech folks working very hard specifically toward electing a Democrat in Virginia. So that kind of thing happens. In addition, there are programs in which, this is not a state that is in play, and this is the bluest part of the bluest state. But your efforts and your money and your energy can go elsewhere, and there are programs that are working to harness that. So those are things that people are doing. You know, obviously there is some degree of disarray. Disarray might be a generous word for it, but a demonstration in the middle of San Francisco, expressing displeasure with the actions of any Republican governor president is not surprising. And a lot of the stuff that Trump is doing is stuff that any president would have done from that party. So some of this energy, the energy is coming out more because of other factors. Let's put it that way.
Yes, Jason, you want to add something there?
I was struck by two things there. Thinking about the energy, I think about the way in which, some of the protests and events at, for instance, in Berkeley, at UC Berkeley. I think about the events around the sort of canceled speech in San Francisco that I think you were referring to, and the way in which the city came together on that, to kind of really, I live right near there, right, express opposition to that, and the way in which I think, although it's been difficult, not allowing the sort of the games that are played by people like Ann Coulter and Milo at UC Berkeley to kind of become more than they might have been otherwise, right? And I think we shouldn't downplay this idea that you said that California's not in play politically. That's actually not, it wasn't a given, right? And the fact that the Democrats are not being divided by perhaps policy choices that Trump might be making, right? Or that what we see instead is Republicans, still being divided on this, right? I think that's actually a political story that's worth telling.
But we may see Democrats being divided in some ways. Let's look at the U.S. Senate race with Dianne Feinstein. Kevin DeLeon is on one hand, and we've seen a split in the Democratic Party since Trump came into power. The struggle between Kimberly Ellis and Eric Bauman to take over the chairmanship of the party was a struggle between the Bernie-crats and the more centrist Democrats. And now that's what we're also seeing in the Senate race. Feinstein being criticized because she said at the Commonwealth Club, well, I think there may be some promise or some hope that Trump could someday maybe be a good president. And she just this last week on, I think it was Meet the Press, said...
Who said you got to give him hope?
Yeah, I mean, I had, that it created a huge issue for her and still is something she has to deal with. And now there's another challenger in that race, even more to the left. And so we'll see if the Democrats... if that split continues, if it gets more rancorous in the Senate race,
I don't think that she's going to have to run very hard.
Yeah.
I don't think this is always what happens. I mean,
yeah, it's not a Trump story. It's a healthy. I think it's actually a healthy competition in the
Democratic
Party.
I think it's a good move for Mr. De Leon. I think he can't lose. He's going to run a good race. He's going to get his name out to Northern California, mm-hmm. where he could walk into this studio and we would ask him, hey, do I know you from somewhere? And that will only help. But
or we could see Tom Steyer get into the race. And this is another place, Joe. You mentioned this is the ATM and money, and we've got Steyer on the air all over the country right now, with ads talking about impeaching Donald Trump. And he's gotten more than, I guess, 1.5 million signatures so far on that campaign in just a couple of weeks. I think that shows, we don't know where he's going, what he may be doing. One of the most interesting things about how California's reacted to Trump could be the national figures that come out of this whole thing, whether we talk about Tom Steyer or Eric Garcetti, who's being looked at as a potential presidential candidate. Certainly Kamala Harris, another one. Until a few weeks ago, Mark Zuckerberg. That's probably a thing in the past now.
Just go with an algorithm. Forget the people,
But California always does. As you all mentioned, California does have a footprint in this. And I think, we're seeing it in a number of different levels.
I'm interested in Garcetti, and I'm interested in what Jason has to say about this, because the Democrats have bungled so badly on the state house level that, something that has been pointed out to me is that the rising stars are folks who are coming from the local level.
I've seen Garcetti at a number of different events recently and watched him give his pitch, and he is now presenting himself as the head of sort of a city state, a nation state of Los Angeles, a city that is bigger than many states, and he's making the case. He could be, he hasn't said it yet, but I think that's where he's going.
Just before you comment there, Jason, I didn't hear Gavin Newsom.
Oh, certainly. I mean, Gavin Newsom is somebody who's being watched all over the country. And I know, I working at Politico in D.C., they're very, very interested in everything he does. That's at the gubernatorial level, I think. Yeah.
Well, I would Jason. Say on Gavin, I think he's showing the power of the Democratic Party in that he's scaring off all the challengers, right? I mean, I think Eric Garcetti is putting himself forward as a contender for president because it would be harder to challenge. It'll probably be easier to get the Democratic nomination for president than it will be to get governor, right? And that's not again, and that's not saying that
right, Jason.
Right. And the fact that we're seeing Republican mayors in San Diego and Fresno not run for that tells me about the weakness of the Republican Party and not just the automatic strength of the Democratic Party, but young. Think about, you said no, Gavin Newsom. Think about all the young leaders that we just talked about.
Kevin Falconer there in San Diego is a moderate Republican who's pro-immigrant. I mean, in any other time, probably would be an extremely strong candidate. They're just because of and because of Donald Trump, anyone with an R after their name is going to have trouble in this state.
And I think I think it's plausible to think hypothetically that if Trump hadn't won, right, there would have been more pressure in the wing of the Republican Party that wants to moderate, that wants to be open to Latinos, right? And yet, I think his victory has re-energized that sort of rump Republican Party to be able to oppose people like Faulkner, right?
Well, they certainly brought in Steve Bannon to their state convention, and I talked about this last time I was on a show on KLW. I don't know if they think that's going to play here in California, but it certainly it got them attention that an absolutely irrelevant state party otherwise wouldn't have gotten, right. And maybe there's some money involved too.
And what's interesting is that I think Maggie Haberman just reported in the New York Times that the New York State Republican delegation, congressional delegation, is not towing the party line on the new tax plan, where we haven't heard that from California's
GOP
delegation.
No, we have not. That's exactly right. And this is going to be a huge problem and for all of these Republican vulnerable Republicans here in California, particularly since you're going to take away the mortgage and interest deduction in California. We know how housing the prices are. Four of the six highest places for home prices in the nation are right here in the Bay Area, with Marin County being number one. A lot of those folks in Orange County, those rich Republicans, are watching that and saying, oh, no, you don't. And yet folks like Daryl Issa and Dana Rohrabacher, these are vulnerable Republicans. They look to be towing the party line so far. That could be something that Nancy Pelosi just loves.
And this is an unpopular president who's dividing his party, not uniting it. That is quite unusual for a president who has united control of the government, a party that has united control of the government, to offer these kinds of divisive policies that are going to hurt their vulnerable members, not help them.
So I want to bring it back to Joe's point. You said it very briefly of just how effective has Sacramento been in terms of legislation in trying to really push back on the Trump agenda?
Yeah.
Let's go through that in a little bit more detail, because you think with the setup, right, of a divisive president, with Sacramento being in the hands of Democrats, that the Democrats would have achieved more in this last year, and that's just not the case.
Well, I think they would look at, for instance, SB1, the sanctuary state bill, which was proposed by Kevin DeLeon as a critical pushback on Trump. And in fact, Jeff Sessions made it very clear in the last week, putting out the message that, great, California, you want to do this? We're going to go back at the funding for California. This is going to be a legal issue that goes on for who knows how long. But they pushed back on that. They pushed back on climate change. As we said, Governor Brown, all over the world, basically, throwing down to Donald Trump on climate change. And that's an area where I'm hearing Republicans are even starting to say, you know what, there is this thing called climate change. A lot of them, including Rick Perry, aren't the energy secretary, aren't acknowledging that it's human caused yet, but they're talking to Representative Scott Peters of San Diego this week. He's on that trip with Jerry Brown. He said, it is happening. You are seeing it. So on those areas. And so immigration is key. Climate change is key. And other things, housing, mm-hmm. gas tax, where California, California's decided, yeah, we're going to pay more for gas so we can pay for roads, infrastructure, and so forth.
And Trump failing to do an infrastructure bill, California's stepping up.
There you go, yeah.
Exactly. But some of these legislative victories didn't come without compromise and concessions. That in some of the press, people are scratching their heads. Why can't the Democrats just kind of push it through? Why does there still have to be compromise and concession?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's always going to be some compromise, because when you have Governor Brown there, I mean, he has been described as the adult in the room. when you have a supermajority in both houses. He's vetoed a number of things, including that bill to mandate that a presidential candidate has to put forward their tax returns. So he's been the guy that's really demanded compromise a lot of times up there in Sacramento, and did so on the sanctuary state bill. A lot of law enforcement were opposed to that bill, said it got in the way of them doing their jobs. And being a former attorney general, he weighed in on it, and that bill was changed.
And the Chamber of Commerce opposing the legislation to not give contracts to any companies who participated in the building of the wall.
Yeah. There's another one, and the wall is another aspect, because some of these prototypes are being built right in San Diego. So we're seeing, I think California has had the impact here.
So are these concessions, are some of these special interests that have gotten Governor Brown's attention, are those worrisome signs about how strong California can be in pushing against Trump?
See, I would even dispute whether it's because of special interest. I think Jerry Brown is focused on governing. And think about this almost unique situation. If he was 10 years younger, he would be the leading contender for president in 2020.
Yeah, I agree with you. No question.
And yet without that political ambition, for instance, he is focused solely on, I think, two things. One, good governance as he sees it, which often means resisting the easy populist things that, you know, contracting symbolic acts that are, you know, important, but symbolic in the sense that they're reactionary to the moment, right? And he's focusing also, I think, on the legacy and future of the Democratic Party. I mean, I think he does not want it. I think he probably sees danger in going too far about Trump and in the moment and rather restraining some of those urges. And I think he sees himself as the lone kind of guardian of kind of maybe restraining some of that. And that might be wrong for the political moment, but I think he's taking a longer view that I think is actually quite unique and fairly impressive.
And I would say one last thing. I would say California has pushed back very hard on the Trump administration with regard to Obamacare. On the national level, as the Trump administration has cut back completely on enrollment, on advertising, California now spends more on advertising for the Affordable Care Act than the entire federal government does. So, I mean, the effort here has been, we know that the Trump effect has been to up the prices of many California health care plans, and Trump keeps saying that the whole thing is collapsing, but California seems to be determined to put out the message, no, it's not, and come on down and enroll. And that is I think that is a key element. And that is a key, that's another issue that's going to be a key danger for these Republican House members here in California. Those of them that voted for the Obamacare repeal.
Yep.
That's going to be a very big deal.
By fiddling with Obamacare is a way to go directly after California. That's a way that dozens of billions of dollars could have been taken away from California. And, you know, among politicians that I spoke with writing stories about this, that was seen as no coincidence. You know, San Francisco and others have been victorious in that lawsuit. And in San Francisco alone, it would have been $1.2 billion. It would have been $2 billion in long term. It would have been $800 million in multi-year federal grants. Mm-hmm. That's serious money. And, you know, something else, we don't know what's going to happen yet, because so far the quality of lawyering from the federal government has been jaw-droppingly poor. Absolutely jaw-droppingly
poor. Not just lawyering. Quality, you know, of governance, policy, anything.
You know, it has not been the best and the brightest. And so, you know, this is, you know, if you're a racing fan, this is the early going when the cars are trying to warm up the tires. You know, we still haven't gotten to the bell lap yet. So,
well, I definitely want to talk about what Washington has in its toolkit to fight back at California's follies. But I wanted to quickly say about single payer health care proposal. What do you think about the fact that didn't go anywhere? Do we say, oh, it wasn't the right time, it was too early, that's not really the point?
Well, I think Speaker Rendon's point was, wait a minute, we need to see the details on this. And I think a lot of folks agreed that there needs to be more fleshing out of how this is going to work. But a lot of people think it can be done, but there are certainly going to be a lot of hurdles to it. And we've seen a growing, I think, by California's effort to have this discussion about single payer has influenced the national discussion. Because when Bernie Sanders proposed it, Kamala Harris was, you know, there on day one saying, I'm behind you on this one. And a lot of people don't feel it's ever going to pass in Washington. But the fact is, California's push here, especially as some of these programs collapse in other states, or they make it exceedingly difficult for people to enroll, and the word kind of right. seeps in about what kind of effects it's going to have on people's lives.
This,
I don't know.
This is classic American federalism, yeah. In the sense that California is showing how to make things work, and other states pay attention, right? And I think the other part of the sort of idea that, it looks like it might be the position of the Democratic Party going forward, that Bernie Sanders sort of, it's a Medicaid for all, correct?
Yeah, right.
And the fact that Kamala Harris signed on, Cory Booker signed on, is very indicative of what it could be for the future of the Democratic Party. And I would say this, there's a part of this that is because of Trump, and that things that he is opposing have become more popular. Look at the public opinion polling on Obamacare and on Medicaid for All as they try to repeal it. Right, there's been a sense of like, don't take that away from us. And look at the NFL protests; like, they're actually more popular when Trump denounces them at times. He is an incredibly unpopular president, and I think you're seeing a lot in California and other places people taking advantage of that to use that energy and generate that energy against him.
I want to reintroduce the program. This is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're discussing California's response to the Trump administration in the last year with our guests Carla Marinucci, California Playbook reporter for Politico and former senior political writer for the San Francisco Chronicle, Joe Eskenazi, editor-at-large with San Francisco Magazine and columnist for Mission Local, and Jason McDaniel, associate professor of political science at San Francisco State University, where he specializes in urban politics and voting behavior. We invite you to call in with your questions or comments. How should California act in response to the Trump administration? Is resistance always the most effective course? The number to dial to join our conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email us at cityvisions@kalw.org, post a comment at the KALW website, or tweet us at cityvisionskalw. So, Joe Eskenazi, back to you. You said that the lawyering coming out of Washington is pretty weak. Tell us more about what your sense is about what Washington can do, but it's just not able to do when it comes to reacting to California, San Francisco, the Bay Area's pushback on the Trump agenda.
Well, so far they've been unable to take the money away. They've been unable to stop us from doing whatever it is that we have set out to do. And there have been ominous warnings and things like that. But so far, the record in court has been very one-sided, astoundingly so, to the point where you get weird and scary statements about judges being made by the executive party, the executive branch of the government. This, at least in San Francisco and throughout California, you see a fair amount of proactive lawyering. This is the city that sued Enron. We do this. So a lot of what San Francisco has done, and you mentioned suing Big Oil at the onset of this program, that would have happened anyway. And I feel I didn't make a point earlier as adequately as I should have. A lot of the things that Donald Trump wants to do are things that any Republican candidate for president would have done. I think the level of vitriol and just out and out hate and mean spiritedness is unique to him, and that will help with some of the people who favor these ends that Donald Trump does, but also help bring people out and bring entities out here that oppose them. So
I would get on top of that and say that it's actually you're right about that Trump is pursuing a Republican agenda. There's no doubt about that. But his particular incompetence, especially think about the transgender ban, the attempt to transgender ban in the military, the Muslim travel ban, both of their spectacularly bad lawyering, and the leadership by the president was vital to those being, the record being set and commented upon by judges, the fact that those things were overturned, partly unique to Trump in that regard. So I think his incompetence is somewhat worth mentioning.
I think one of the interesting things about what we've seen in the past year has been the uncertainty that the Trump administration has created in California in so many different areas. And let's just talk about like legal cannabis, for instance. That here we have an industry that was about to launch or is about to launch in January. Billions of dollars potentially at stake. An entire industry sort of gearing up here for becoming the largest cannabis market, legal cannabis market in the world, and yet the Attorney General throws this kind of uncertainty to it. Are they going to come down on it? What are they going to do? And we still don't know. Immigration is another one where. I know I've heard from farmers in the Central Valley and Salinas area saying that the uncertainty that the Trump administration has created, even on just agricultural workers, has meant millions of dollars of crops have rotted in the fields in California. When you have crops like lettuce, strawberries, and so forth, they have to be picked by hand. The workers aren't there, and I've heard. Uncertainty from folks in the tourism industry because you've got hotels and restaurants dependent on immigrant labor. And, you know, Trump has celebrated the fact that, well, you know, illegal immigration is cut down, and that is true. But nobody's addressed the issue of who's going to do the work here because, as we know, in the fields in California, 60 to 70% of the workers in the fields are undocumented workers here.
So is uncertainty a strategy here to keep everyone guessing and running in different directions, or is it truly just not knowing what to do?
I think the answer is yes. And in this particular case, yes, there are, you know, I don't think that the federal government loses sleep over anybody in California being concerned about anything. I don't think that we're on their radar, and I think that, you know, it's a good idea to have 3 days' worth of supplies at home because they're not coming to dig you out. I think that that's been demonstrated pretty quickly. In this particular case, I would say that the real damage is you asked about the lawyering. Trying to come through the front door has not worked for this administration, but they can still do a great deal of damage going through the back door. The educational Betsy DeVos has done great damage to the educational system. The Secretary of the Interior, Zinke, has done great damage. Scott Pruitt has done great damage to the EPA. And the same can be said with immigration. We, you know, in the greatest humanitarian crisis of perhaps any of our lives, we have shut the borders down to people in need. This is really affecting people's lives, as are, you know, not just the uncertainty. The number of people being deported has gone up. It wasn't like Immigration and Customs Enforcement was a big city liberal organization in the past. But I have the numbers for you here. The number of detainers they've called for in our jail has gone through the roof. Mm-hmm. And that's something else, that we already had those policies in place of not cooperating with them. But, you know, this is worth taking a second notice on here. In 2016, the entire year, we had 99 requests from ICE. As of November 1st, 401 this year. Mm-hmm. And there are more and more every day. Sometimes there'll be 7 on a Monday. So, you know, this is relentless. They understand that incentivization of moving people out as quickly as possible. And you know, it's not just uncertainty. You know, I think people have a right to feel afraid because they're definitely coming for you, and we haven't yet seen how bad it can get.
I would absolutely. The fear, and that's the one when I think about ICE and some of the things that, you know, we've heard about them doing, absolutely, you know, immoral and outrageous. And yet, I actually would think about it in terms of a president who had competent cabinet-level staff, not just he's really has scraped the bottom of the barrel, not only in his own personal staff, but these cabinet staff almost uniformly are, you know, people who would work with him, and they are the bottom of the barrel, right? And I think you could make an argument that they've unleashed ICE, but it's out of control, and they're not exerting control in D.C. over it. You know, I think it's an organization that feels unleashed, and there's going to be major blowback in terms of public opinion that already is in California. But I guarantee you, if I'm somebody who was actually competently strategizing about immigration, right, I wouldn't want these stories, you know, about young women, you know, girls, you know, asking for abortions or being taken out of marriage and family court or on and on and on. These are not the stories they want, and I think it reflects a lack of control and competence in the White House that is permeated every aspect of their policy.
And I think when we talk about immigration, too, one other area that is really important to California is the H-1B visas in Silicon Valley. Mm-hmm. After this recent terrorist incident in New York, Trump immediately called for a look at H-1B visas, an end to chain immigration. And this kind of policy, I think we haven't calculated the effects on the center of the innovation economy, which is here in Silicon Valley, because I've heard from folks there saying, look, when you've got, you know, talented tech people who are ready to come over here and they're deciding where to go, and the president is making statements like that, we'll just go to China or Canada. These countries are, you know, sucking up the best and the brightest who maybe don't want to come to Silicon Valley anymore. And that's I think the effects of that are yet to be felt.
Not just Silicon Valley.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, infrastructure, we've talked about, you mentioned infrastructure. Infrastructure in the United States is not in a good place. And, you know, this country doesn't produce engineers. If you go to an engineering school graduation at a major university, I would say it's a fair bet that most of these people were not born in the United States. If you make it harder for these people to obtain educations in the United States, you are really shooting yourself in the foot, and things will start to fall apart. And, you know, I have personal experience in this. I married a foreign-born engineer. And, mm-hmm. you know, in the country where she's from, France, people are encouraged to become engineers. And I have to tell you that bridges get built on time and under budget. You know, it's incredible what a difference you get in a society where that is encouraged. And here in the United States, we have been, you know, getting by on our academic excellence and our desirability for a long time. And people come here and they stay here. And, you know, that's where a lot of your structural engineers, your mechanical engineers are coming from.
Yeah, and the Trump administration attacking universities and research programs, both in terms of the uncertainty and fear driving away people from other countries who may not want to come here and choose other countries because of it. But in the tax plan most recently, too, they're taxing graduate PhD fellow salary stipends mm-hmm. in a way that professors are generally kind of in shock. There's so much bad stuff in there, but that could cripple American higher education.
Yeah, by one analysis, this tax bill basically takes away any incentive for higher education in the sense of, or at least many of them, one of them being interest on your student loans and scholarships.
Again, this is City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're discussing California under the Trump administration with Carla Marinucci, California Playbook reporter for Politico, Joe Eskenazi, editor-at-large at San Francisco Magazine and columnist for Mission Local, and Jason McDaniel, associate professor of political science at San Francisco State University. We have our phone lines open for you to join our conversation. How do you feel about Trump's presidency and its impact on California? The number to dial to join our conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can email us at cityvisions@kalw.org, post a comment at the KLW website, and tweet us at cityvisionskalw. So we're close to Russia. We're close to North Korea. Tell us, how has the state responded to that?
The Russia story, who would ever predict how much of it would be? Come right back here to California when you watched the executives from Facebook, Google, and Twitter, all of them located right here in the Bay Area, testifying before Congress. And now, I mean, news stories are coming out even today talking about the links between the Kremlin-supported businesses and Facebook. This is a story that has yet to be, you know, fully spun out. But the fact is, the role of these companies, these powerhouse companies in the Bay Area, and their links with Russia and their knowingly or unknowingly in affecting the election of 2016 is something that I think pains a lot of people.
Especially Joe here.
Especially Joe. He looks
he looks very pained.
He looks very pained, yeah.
I think we need to take a deep look at the founding ethoses of these companies with regard to what they said they would do for society. And is that really the case, or are they just greedy corporations out to make a buck? You know, when a tech company you know, says what's good for us is good for the United States and talks about innovation, we think, well, that's great. But, you know, if the head of a petroleum company or an automobile company said what's good for us is good for the United States, like, oh, you're just a greedy, you know, businessman. Right. So I think that a lot of that has happened. And I think that move fast and break things in retrospect was probably not a great idea because we've moved fast and we broke things.
And this is where, like, if someone other than Trump was president, right, that – the idea that there's not been the majority party is not responding to an attack on our democracy, right? By directing resources and attention to that fact, Trump is preventing that from happening. And if we had a different president, you might see more regulatory energy towards Facebook and Twitter and others about protecting, you know, our democracy in terms of the free communications and getting rid of fake news and all of that. That is something that presidents can do, is that exert that kind of moral leadership, and this president's incapable of it.
And a lot of these are here in the Bay Area. Can Bay Area citizens, government, do something that the federal government can't?
I
won't.
You know,
we gave them a tax break.
I think what's interesting to watch from the big picture, because I just covered the state Republican convention where Steve Bannon spoke, and it was interesting to watch him target these companies as the technology lords, you know, the elite technology lords, which need to be taken down, along with the academic elites and the, you know. And so
don't forget the media,
and
too.
The media elites as well. We media elites. But the fact is that, I mean, it's interesting to watch that the Bannon wing of the Republican Party sort of start formulating that. You know, remember, Bannon was the guy who identified the wall and illegal immigration as the issues that Trump would ride on to become the next president. And talking to Joshua Green, who wrote a great book called Devil's Bargain, the book about the bio of Steve Bannon last week, he mentioned that, you know, this Bannon now may be focusing on a new target, and that is these companies right here in the Bay Area. The idea that these are technology lords, and we'll see if it comes from the right. If the calls for regulation come from the right, the fact is these are large media companies. 52% of Americans get their news from Facebook, so there is going to be some kind of and I think we're going to see Mark Zuckerberg, Sheryl Sandberg, Sergey Brin testifying before Congress.
Well, hopefully, because, yeah, you know, stiffing them like that was kind of jaw-dropping.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, considering this did have a factor, and they are, you know, it's more and more they are either collusive or got played to a big degree, so it's kind of unusual to stiff.
So is there any talk in Sacramento about doing something to regulate?
No, it's interesting that the Democratic Party itself, in its sort of new agenda that it's put out, the DNC's new agenda, which is called A Better Deal, talks about tackling big monopolies, and people have assumed this means Facebook, some of these big. But the fact is, breaking up a company like Facebook, I think the folks in Sacramento understand this too, is a monumental, if not maybe impossible, task. Think about this company. Mark Zuckerberg has been CEO of this company since he was, 19? And, and now he's 33. That's incredible. Almost half his life already. That is unheard of in American business. Yeah. And I think the company itself and its reach, as somebody pointed out, there are more Facebook users than there are Christians on the planet, I think, at this point. 2.2 billion. How do you break that up? That's the question. I think it's going to be interesting to.
I think the Democratic Party will have to deal with this. Yeah. I mean, I think there is that idea in that part of the party that wants to create the kind of populist villains, you know, and yeah. Bannon shares that kind of ethos. Yeah. But there, of course, you know, that kind of energy sometimes, on the left as well. I think the more powerful way to think about this is not, again, about, you know, reining in some monopolistic corporation, though that's certainly a valid conversation to have, but rather thinking again about our democracy, right? Championing our democracy, championing voting rights, ending voter suppression, thinking about the Facebook and Twitter stuff in terms of electoral communications. That's for me. Now, that's what I study, so maybe I'm biased. But that's, to me, is the more powerful sense of uniting Americans around defending our values in our democracy.
I want to put the phone number out again. This is City Visions on 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at KALW.org. We're discussing California under the Trump administration with our guests Carla Marinucci, Joe Eskenazi, and Jason McDaniel. The number to dial to join our conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email us at cityvisions@kalw.org, post a comment at the KALW website, or tweet us at cityvisionskalw. Let's go to Ariana from San Francisco.
Thank you for taking my call. I want to remark that I think it's good not to assume too much. When you think about chaos and confusion strategically being delivered, we can think about the province of thieves. And it's quite possible with the electronic voting machines and the gerrymandering and the removal of voting machines in communities of color that the Democrats could suffer future losses as well. And the only thing I could say that could be really positive about this whole thing is that for many Americans who still remain complacent about politics and the future of this planet, that their entry into the political discourse is coming through a sort of theatrical or amusing or entertainment-oriented newsfeed and president, which is a very sad and sorry state of affairs, but that's what we need to reckon with as a country. Time is running out for humanity. We really have to reckon with who we are as a country and our moral compass.
Thank you so much, Arya, for your call. Jason, do you want to say something about that?
Well, I do think when the caller mentioned the idea of bringing people into politics, and I think every day about the record number of women that are going to be running for office, you know, for the first time or you know, and very much in response to I think what's going on with Donald Trump. And that to me is one of a great reason for optimism, right? And also I think getting the Democratic Party to focus on voting rights, whether it be about, you know, gerrymandering, voting machines, I think those are things to look at, but rather really reinvigorating the Voting Rights Act, going back to that civil rights sort of core of the Democratic Party and championing that, fighting voter suppression, these kinds of making voting easier, these are the kinds of things that I think can energize the Democratic Party.
So the topic of the show tonight is California Bay Area. Given where we are, what can California and the Bay Area do to influence some of these issues?
Well, I think, you know, the caller brought up hacking and that whole issue, and I think this has got to be still a major concern. I know speaking to Secretary of State Alex Padilla, he has said they know that the Russians were knocking on the door. The Russians, or maybe it was the North Koreans or the Chinese, I'm not exactly sure, but there were attempted hacks on the California voting system that did not work the last time around. But he has warned, and others have warned, that doesn't mean it's not going to happen again. And states know that they have to be prepared. The question is, are Republicans going to get behind the calls to increase security and to look into what exactly happened last time around? I think California does have to worry about this. Right now, our system did hold. And then on the other flip side of it, the issue of voter suppression in other states has got to be something that concerns both Republicans and Democrats alike. And that is not really being addressed.
But how could California influence that?
I would say California has more sway in the first part of your argument, the first thing that Carla brought up with the sanctity of the voting process, at least within our borders. That's something that is done on a district by district level. In San Francisco, I know that they have paper backup records. I complain a lot about city government, but one of the departments that's doing pretty well right now is the Department of Elections. We are not like places you've seen that don't have a paper record, mm-hmm. that, you know, truly are vulnerable, are using machines that hackers can hack faster than an expert can turn the Rubik's Cube, you know? Far as the Voting Rights Act, that's something, you know, these are, again, incremental things that have added up through time. The Supreme Court decision was monumental. Rolling back the Voting Rights Act, you know, when you look at the margins of victory in those states, it was a very big deal. And that's not something beyond efforts to try and get the right candidates elected, et cetera, you know, I'm not sure what this state can do about that, because that is the nation's problem.
Well, I think, you know, something the state is doing, like automatic voter registration, again, leading the way in the idea of trying to make it easy for people to vote. But also, I think, you know, it's focusing on election security. Republicans hear that, and a lot of people hear that, and they think, well, let's make it harder to vote, right? That speaking up for the integrity of our system. and showing leadership. Again, some politicians, you know, sort of talk about voter fraud or rigged elections or, you know, rigged primaries, right? And I think fighting back against that and helping to try to restore some of the faith that Americans may have lost about their electoral process is something that I think the Democratic Party can do, and Republicans have too long of a history of not doing
that. And let's remember Trump's, you know, commission on voter fraud is still operative. Chris Kobach is still demanding that the states turn over information. And here in California, Alex Padilla is one of the first secretaries of state to challenge that legally and say, no, it's not going to happen.
Right.
But we'll see. But they haven't given up. The Trump administration has not given up on that idea of pursuing the voter fraud, what he has said millions. He has said millions of people voted illegally.
This is a difficult
situation. He was wrong about that.
This is a difficult
situation because it's almost like debating with a Holocaust denier. You know, you are giving that person a platform with an undeniably false point of view. And sadly, in this particular case, the people who are saying that there's been widespread voting fraud, that illegal immigrants are showing false IDs and voting, which is the most remarkably preposterous thing you could possibly do. This is such a crazy idea on its face that you're almost self-defeating to debate someone about such a thing.
Except the Republican Party believes that.
Well, I was going to say a lot of these preposterous propositions all seem to have legs, though.
Right. I mean, again, there's, you know, decades and almost a century of people taking ideas of the insecurity of our system and using the idea of voter fraud, which is a myth, right, to create rules and laws to make it harder for people to vote. And it's a long history of Democrats and Republicans doing that. I think the Democratic Party is finally, or maybe not finally, but they are much better on that these days than they have been in the past. And I think speaking up for that leadership and rather than spreading cynicism about elections is important.
I want to get a caller in here, but go ahead, Joe.
I think it is, but on the other hand, I don't think the people pushing that argument believe that argument. I think that's a red herring to play into people's insecurities. I don't think Chris Kobach believes that argument. I think Chris Kobach just wants to throw people off the voters' rolls, and he's coming up with a convenient, you know, myth that illegal immigrants are voting. I don't believe that he believes his argument.
Not a point we can prove or disprove tonight. Let's go to Jonah from Oakland. Jonah, welcome to the program.
How you doing? I think a couple of you know me. I'm a former journalist, and so my question's a little biased, but I was hoping you guys could speak a little bit to the impact of the deterioration of local media in general and kind of what's going on.
Well, I can go to that one.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening, Jonah. I think, you know, I've had respectful disagreements with editors that were very disheartened by Donald Trump's victory and questioned the worth of what they were doing. You know, what does it matter to cover local issues when you know, someone who, you know, perhaps the person that you would least want to be president in the entire world is president? And, you know, what does it matter? And I think it matters more to not get caught in Arcana and not cover trivial things, but to cover what's going on in local government, because the people who are doing wrong, malfeasant people, or people who just want to make business as usual are counting on you not paying attention because of the sideshow coming out of Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. It's kind of an unintended trickle-down effect of cover for those who, you know, either malfeasant or just business as usual are governing in a way that the people ought to know about. I think that, you know, cynicism with local politicians is something I've brought this up before. You know, love Ed Lee or hate him, he broke the one promise he made that was why he got the job, which is I won't run for re-election. And when asked about it, too many local people said, it's what politicians do, as if you just have to take it. This kind of cynicism is self-defeating in the end. You don't have to take it.
I just want to say that I think, you know, the Trump administration, more than ever, local reporting is important to voters and to just citizens and their knowledge of government. But I think we've watched the Trump administration have sort of a trickle-down attitude, or, you know, the attitude has been trickled-down. I noticed the L.A. Times right now is being boycotted by Disney. That has refused to allow its reporters to review Disney films because the L.A. Times did a tremendously great series on Anaheim and Disney's effects on Anaheim. I think that kind of action by a major corporation would never have been taken in the past. But when you have a president who has called the media the enemy of the people, and the attitude has ramped up so much in social media that a corporation like Disney thinks it can get away with that. I noticed there's a a campaign on social media beginning yesterday to subscribe to the LA Times out of protest, and it seems to be taking off. I'm glad to see that.
Yeah, I mean, I
brief comment here.
I look at local media and just in the room and see a lot of vibrant local media. I also see a lot of vibrant national media really holding, you know, trying to hold the Trump administration to account. And, you know, that makes me more optimistic than not.
Hmm. Just in the last couple of minutes that we have, is there any place where it would benefit California to go along with the Trump administration? I think of infrastructure, for example.
I think infrastructure is a great idea. And I think a lot of people are waiting for that to happen. California decided to go on its own with the gas tax. But certainly, you know, we've watched California have some major issues, the fires, and we haven't heard a lot from Trump. It took 11 days for him to even comment on that. And whether, you know, the Santa Rosa area can recover from the fires, we'll see if the Trump administration comes through.
I think on DACA and the DREAM Act, you know, the Democratic Party tends to be more in favor of working to get benefits from government. And so when Chuck and Nancy, if they work with Trump to get things that their supporters want, I think the Democratic Party supporters will appreciate that.
What do you think, Joe?
I think Dianne Feinstein, you know, when I got to interview her about this about a year ago, and she said, you know, I can't get money for the state without the president's signature. There is a degree of cooperation that you need to have. It doesn't mean that you have to swallow, you know, that you have to do terrible things in return for it. But simply deciding if Trump's in favor of water, I'm not going to bathe, won't help. It won't help. At some degree, you have to have the
but you're talking about the Republicans' whole tactic over the last 8 years.
Yes, and see how well that's done for them. You know, I mean, yes, they have all this power, but what have they done with it?
Exactly right.
Let's try to squeeze in another call here. We'll have William from Belvedere. William, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Although I'm very much against voter suppression, of course, I think to blame that for the Democrats' failure is putting the blame in the wrong place. The Democratic establishment of the Democrat Party, it does not want, for instance, Medicare for all. They don't want free public education for public universities. They don't want a decrease in the military budget, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so people don't vote because the vote doesn't seem to make any difference in their lives. At least that's my perspective. And if you disagree with it, I'd like you to say why.
Thanks so much for your call. Who wants to take that one?
I would just point out that Hillary Clinton got over 3 million more votes than Donald Trump did. So, I mean, I think people did vote. The turnout was down a little bit, but I don't think it was because the Democratic Party candidate and platform didn't excite people. I don't think that's it.
So we touched very briefly about, you know, how everyday citizens can get more involved. Let's wrap up with that, and because we've talked a lot about how legislators and others are trying to push back. What can everyday citizens do besides or in addition to marching in the streets?
Call the member of Congress. You know, I know members of Congress heard from Californians when Obamacare repeal is up and the tax bill is up right now. Call members of Congress.
Yeah, I think that's critical. I know they pay attention to that. And I would also say you do have to support your local media. And I think that's critical to the process right now.
That keeps us employed. And also do look into things like the Immigrant Liberation Movement. It's immigrantliberation.com. These are the people who are trying to come up with rapid responses when there is an immigration raid, and they can, you know, this is instead of just blockading the street randomly because you're upset about Trump, you can this is directed. Also, I can get you another website. I took the trouble of writing it down. SFILDC.org is the consortium of immigration lawyers and organizations. Those are the people to get in contact with. Maybe you have skills. Maybe you're a programmer. You know, they will find a use for you if you can do it.
And we'll put these links on our website as well. Well, I want to thank my guests tonight, Carla Marinucci, California Playbook reporter for Politico and former senior political writer for the San Francisco Chronicle, Joe Eskenazi, editor-at-large with San Francisco Magazine and columnist for Mission Local, and Jason McDaniel, associate professor of political science at San Francisco State University. Thanks to all of you for joining me tonight.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
And that's City Visions. Thanks to all of you for listening. For a link to this and other City Visions shows to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page at kalw.org. Our engineer this evening was David LaTulipe. Tonight's show was produced by our senior producer, Susie Britton. Please join my co-host, Ethan Elkind, next Monday as we talk about how rideshare companies like Uber and Lyft have impacted Bay Area traffic. This is Joseph Pache. Thanks for listening. Good night and have a great week.